Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, everyone. You are listening to This Week in Health Innovation, and I am your co-host, Greg Masters, and joining me, as always on these broadcasts, is my partner, Dr. Pat Salver. Pat, are you with us?
I sure am.
And we are, I don't know if it's bi-coastal, but again, we're resuming. I'm in San Diego, Pat's in Marin County. And we have a special guest on the line, someone who's near and dear to our hearts. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about that individual, which I've come to know as Margaret Maggie Carey, who is a physician with an MBA and an MPH. And I would direct you to an introductory piece on Dr. Carey over at the Health Innovation Broadcast Consortium, otherwise known as HIBC.tv, and you get a flavor for Dr. Carey as she showed up at the XX in Health Retreat, which was in June. She conducted a group-level consulting class, and I assume we'll hear a little bit more about that shortly, but let me give you a high-level background on Maggie. She's a D.C.-based executive and leadership coach and consultant who works with both corporate and physician executives. Clients include physicians and healthcare executives at the University of Maryland School of Medicine, the Mayo Clinic, University of South Florida, University of Massachusetts Medical School, University in, I'm sorry, that's redundancy, also a support TED coach and TED Med Great Challenge facilitator. Maggie is also a clinical assistant professor at Georgetown University School of Medicine and director of physician leadership development at the Veterans Health Administration. Today we'll discuss Dr. Carey's interest in executive coaching, how she was drawn to it, and the role that it plays in the healthcare transformation that we're all a part of at this point. So with that as a general background, I'm going to turn it over to you, Pat, and help us get to know Dr. Carey.
Okay, great. Maggie, we're so glad you could join us today. And I thought I would start out by, you have a very interesting current resume, but you have also a fascinating and rich long-term resume. And I thought it would be of interest to our listeners for you to tell them a little bit about how you went from going to medical school to where you are today, much in demand executive coach.
Well, Pat, that's an interesting question, and so I'll talk to you a little bit about starting off. I wanted to be a doctor, decided in fourth grade, because I really liked science. I was a kid that was poking the dead animals to see what was inside them because I like science so much, and I thought that there's probably not a big future in poking dead animals, but there might be one in medicine. So I decided to become a physician because I thought I could help people. And as I worked through that and through my various degrees, I've done a lot of things. I was a family doctor, Santa Rosa, California, over on your side of the country. And then I moved to Mammoth Lakes, where I worked for a year as working in an emergency room, and then to Denver, where I stayed 20 years and had a number of different jobs, including I was a post in the Clinton administration, working with Donna Shalala and driving Hillary around in my 1982 Land Cruiser, and also vice president of a medical device startup, chief medical officer of a $200 million a year ad agency. I was in the Colorado Business Group on Health. You and I chatted about that at the time. And I wrote one of the first books on healthcare technology, which I've just been asked to do a second edition of, called Telemedicine and Telehealth, Principles, Policies, Performance, and Pitfalls. And as you know, that telemedicine is now taken for granted. And along all of this, one of the things I observed as I got my MBA, as I got other degrees, was that the way we're taught in medical school really isn't the best way to learn how to be a good manager or a good leader. So as we go into healthcare reform, where we're going to be paid for teamwork, it seems to me that physicians have a stake in learning how to work effectively in teams. This is actually confirmed by a lot of research showing that where you have teams of providers, doctors, nurses, social workers, fewer patients die, fewer patients get sick. So there's a lower morbidity and mortality rate. This research has been out for a while, which sort of makes you wonder, why hasn't anything been done sooner? Again, I think it's the training we get. So I work one-on-one with physicians who are either into or going into leadership or management roles, and work with them on how they show up to others and what the perception is. And it's work I just love.
Well, certainly needed. So many questions I have about this. I think the first question is, do you think that medical students and residents are still being trained the way you and I were? I mean, I was trained that, yes, I was a part of the team, but I was the leader of the team and everybody was supposed to do what I said. And I think in certain surgical specialties that kind of training is even more pronounced than it was in my field, which was internal medicine. So are we still putting that out there for medical students and residents as a matter in which they interact with teams? And if that's the case, is a lot of what you do trying to undo what happened to people when they were in training?
Yeah, I'm going to think about that just for a minute. That's an interesting perspective, because I'm going to suggest that perhaps if you were an intern or a resident or medical school, you thought less that it was an effective team than if you were the attending. Because as I remember medical school, and as many people do, is that it was fairly abusive, which is probably why physicians bond with each other so well, because we all have some minor form or major form of PTSD, a shared experience. So
that's an interesting perspective.
So I would say that the teams didn't usually include anybody not at some sense of resident of medical training. The nurses were sort of ancillary generally, is my recollection. Although I have to say that they saved my rear end only too many times when a patient started crashing at night and I was the only when I was in residency. So I think the concept that there's a study done by a guy at Children's Hospital here in D.C. And what he showed, he queried nurses and doctors about, do you have an effective team? It was in the neonatal intensive care unit, you know, very, very premature babies and often quite sick. And what was interesting is there were wild variants, and it was usually the doctors that said we had a great team and the nurses said we suck. And actually, I have to say, every time it was the doctor, when there was a huge difference, the doctors would say we have a great team and the nurses would say, not so good. But as the doctors and nurses as a group start getting closer so that they both think they're good teams, fewer babies died. Fewer babies were sick. And so,
how does that tie into what you're doing now, Maggie? I mean, can you take those docs that had this misperception that they had a great team when they didn't and train them out of it or coach them out of it?
Well, usually they come, they find me or they're sent to me because in some kind of review, a 360 review, which is a 360 assessment, is where the person grades him or herself with a bunch of different questions and also asks his or her boss, colleagues, and then direct reports to also do that. And if there's a huge difference, usually it's the client thinks I'm great and the other people say not so fast. So what I do is get called in as a coach, which is to hold up a mirror to them. I'm not a consultant. I'm not I'm a somebody who holds up a mirror and says, well, so what about that? What do you think? So let me tell you a story. I had a most of my clients right now are surgeons, interestingly enough. I happen to love working with surgeons. And one of my clients was known for blowing up And this particular person was very, very dedicated to his succession planning, to his residence, to the help. But when he felt that there was something, when he felt that there wasn't something quite right, he'd blow up. Well, you know, this has a devastating effect on people. So one of our turning points during coaching was when I asked this person, so what's a good leader to you? And he said, well, let's see, a good leader is listens to me, looks at both sides, is very calm, and went on for a few more words, and then there was a long silence. And then, oh. So if I had said to him, a good leader does this, does that, you know, we'd be a good leader, it probably wouldn't have been as effective as for him to say that to me and then to realize that that wasn't how he was showing up to other people.
Yeah. And that's the mirror piece. You look at the mirror and it's not quite as pretty as you had hoped it would be.
Right. And as physicians, it's emotional intelligence is a critical part of this. As physicians, we tend to be pretty good at reading other people's emotions. We're not so good at modulating our own emotions to react to the emotions we've just seen. So, for instance, we sometimes say, well, I know it's not a good time, but I just got to say it. And as a regular person, you wouldn't go ask your boss for a raise on the day that he was in a really foul mood that just found out some horrible news. You'd want to wait until he's in a better mood.
Yeah, absolutely. And so do you think, Maggie, part of the issue that we have with physicians who require coaching, does it have anything to do with how we choose who gets into medical school and who doesn't? Or is it really that you come into medical school and you could end up functioning well in teams, but it, you know, as we talked about before, it gets kind of cultured out of you?
There's an interesting medical school right now that I learned about through the Association of American Medical Colleges in Florida. And what they've done is they have accept students in the regular program, but they also have a second program in which part of the admissions process is an emotional intelligence test. The students that they take, the cohort they take, tend to be a little older, tend to have had different life experiences. And what they do is before they start medical school, they have them go through a leadership training program in Boston. They bring them back. And for the first 2 years, well, for all 4 years, they have coaches. And there's two coaches per eight students, as I recall. And they spend the first 2 years in Florida at the medical school, and then they go up to the Lehigh Valley Health Network, which is a series of hospitals up in Lehigh Valley in Pennsylvania, and that's where they're doing their clinical work. The first class to do clinical work in Pennsylvania just left this month in July. So they're up there. But what they do is they select for different characteristics. They give them leadership training. They provide them coaching as they go through medical school. And what they're finding now is they are less distressed by the experience in medical school. They're much more accepting of it. Here's another really interesting piece. One of the faculty members' kids said to him when he came home Wednesday night, said, Dad, I really like having dinner with you on Wednesdays because you're in such a good mood. That's the day he coaches the medical students.
Ah, interesting. Well, that's a fascinating model. And I'm assuming, because you are telling us about this, that there must be some organized study of the results. So at some point we'll be able to see if you went through this program with the ongoing coaching and that you were chosen for some degree of emotional intelligence, that you end up being a better physician. And the question is, does it matter what kind of physician? Are these physicians who are going to go into primary care? Once they go through that program, are they still likely to go into primary care? There's a lot of really interesting questions about that.
Absolutely. And I think, this is the third year, so they've just got their first year going into clinical studies, the clinical sciences. But this will be interesting to learn about.
Yeah, very interesting. I remember when I was in training, they had two tracks for internal medicine. One was primary care internal medicine, and the other was straight internal medicine. or that's what we called it then. And and it was really very interesting that at the end, it didn't matter which program you went into, most of the folks who went through the training program ended up doing something besides primary care. They either became a specialist, or a huge number of people in my training group went into emergency medicine, which was, you know, a brand new specialty at the time, and there weren't a lot of residencies. So it'll be really interesting to see with these specialty selected students and all the special training, you know, what ends up happening, and whether we can, you know, kind of stench the problem of not enough people choosing primary care. So Maggie, I know you do. You also teach medical students, and you have a very interesting course that I want to talk about a little bit here, called Narrative Medicine. What on earth is that, and what are you up to?
Well, the term was actually coined by a woman, Rita Sharon, at Columbia, and she has a PhD, as well as being a physician. She has a PhD in English Lit, I think, and so what she started was this concept of reflective writing, and as you probably know, with adult learning, reflective writing is sort of how we process things in our brain. We process them in our brain, but if we write them down, there's a slightly different process. And she has a program where, and it's mostly about writing, sort of trying to make sense of all the things that happen in medical school, many of which aren't so positive. And what I did is I took that model and I decided to teach first-year medical students at Georgetown. And what I've done is that first of all, it's a pass-fail class, and I'm there to encourage them to be bold. So I give them the syllabus and I say, here's what you need to do. If you do everything, you're going to pass. Now I want you to be bold. And so their essays tend to be filled with the wonder of becoming physicians, about how they like science, also things in their past that may have driven them to practice medicine. And I think they're published on The Doctor Weighs In. Thank you. They really like that. And on a couple, occasionally on some other blogs. And what I'm finding is that over the course, it's an 8-week course, 2 hours each time. At the end of the 8-week course, the students really feel they know each other a lot better. And we talked about this on my last course. And I tried to debrief with them a little bit on it. I think it might be a little too touchy-feely, especially in the beginning. But by hearing other people's stories, they realize that people do have stories and they are individual. And what I'm hoping is that as they reflect on the things they learn in medical school and the patients they've seen and the things like that, that they realize every patient also has a story, much like the people in the class. And, you know, you can comment, the writing is brilliant. I mean, just so thoughtful. There's also some work out of Brown University that says that medical students that go through a reflective writing program, not necessarily narrative medicine, but the drop-offs in empathy, which typically occur after the first and third years, do not drop off as quickly or as deep. So what I'm trying to do is
interesting.
Yes, so that would be another interesting an interesting study. But if all you have to do is look at Atul Gawande and Pauline Shen and Jerome Groopman and the doctors that are writing, and I have to say Atul Gawande probably is the biggest inspiration for my students to want to go into writing, or as it often turns out to get back into writing. They just had been writing maybe in high school and when they started college, and then they had to focus on getting into medical school and so gave it up for a while.
Well, it's really incredible. I have read a number of these as they show up on my blog, The Doctor Weighs In, and they really are amazing pieces of work. I don't want to put you on the spot or have you highlight one person against another, but are there a couple of real standouts that you'd like to talk to the listeners about in terms of the stories?
You know, everyone has its points. And there was one called Mind Water that just really resonates, where the student talked in the beginning, the cadaver was a name with quotes around it, and by the end of the essay, the quotes were removed because he went through his process of realizing this was a person. And I remember one scene particularly well, holding the brain in his hand, watching the formaldehyde fall away from it, and likening that to the thoughts of the woman whose body, you know, whose cadaver it was. But I'd like to talk about the ones I think we got the most comments on was called Thin White Female. Do you remember that one?
Yeah, I do.
And it was very interesting. The story is of the writer Samantha, having some anxiety and going to doctors and going to a doctor and sort of being blown off and going to another doctor. And the second doctor said, "Oh, you have thin white female disease."
Hey, that's something I want to have, the thin part.
Heavy on the thin part, exactly. I actually got the other two down. And what was interesting is that there are a lot of comments on this, and one writer actually took her to task because she had said both doctors were men, and taking a stance that these two that she was coming out against male doctors. And the interesting part was she wasn't. They just happened to be male doctors. That wasn't the point. The point was, no matter what the gender of the doctor, to pay attention to your patients. And what happens is when we get comments like that, we use them for discussion. And I happened to have Ellen Ficklin as my guest speaker that week, and she used to was the head of narrative matters on health affairs. And she said that they called that when you put things like that in that might provoke a reaction you didn't want, there was a term for that, and I unfortunately can't use it on radio, but it's called the blank handles. And what she said was that you have to be very careful about that and plan for that. You can put those kinds of things in, but realize that people are going to come after you about something that it wasn't your intention to do. So I thought it was an interesting piece, just the way she framed it. I would be interested in your thoughts if you'd want to share them.
So my thoughts exactly on what, Maggie?
Your thoughts on the narrative medicine and about the whole concept of, you know, thin white.
Female. First of all, I think. I've enjoyed it from a pure reader point of view, that these are great short stories. And it's really good writing. So I've really enjoyed that. But I also think this whole idea that you talked about, and the one story that you just told wasn't the only one where a medical student wrote about a cadaver. There was a recent one where the writer, it was a woman, kind of likened it to burying, I think it was a bird in her front yard when she was young. And this whole transformation of thinking of the cadaver as a cadaver, but then by the end, you know, realizing that this was a person who had made this incredible gift to medicine by donating their body, which isn't, you know, something that most people think about doing or would perhaps be comfortable doing. So in my mind, she expressed that journey that you're talking about, from the patient as a thing, you know, the guy, the headache in bed 4, right? How many times have we talked about patients that way, to, oh no, this is a person who had a story and has people that, you know, love them, and, you know, had this life, whatever it was, and that I'm privileged to be a part of that. And I think if narrative medicine helps to instill that, you know, kind of rehumanizing aspects of medicine, it would be fantastic, because we've broken a lot of things in medicine, but I think, and we like to talk a lot about the doctor-patient relationship, but I personally think that, you know, when you've shortened your interaction to 10 to 15 minutes, and by the way, I really better chart and I better do this and I have all these things I have to do, I don't necessarily feel like I have the time to engage with you as a human being.
Right, exactly. And may I talk briefly just about another medical school program I think you'd be interested in?
Sure, great.
So Harvard, the Cambridge Hospital in Cambridge, Massachusetts, is a safety net hospital, and I met a man who's the head of that, and he started a program through medical students pick this pick this track, Harvard medical students. And what they do is they spend all 4 years at Cambridge Hospital with the same patients and the same attendings. And one of the things that one of the medical students said in the third year, somebody came in who was, you know, a very old patient with bed sores or something, and this student said, you know, if I didn't know this patient, I'd think it was an old patient with bed sores, and that would be it. But I know this person's story, and I am very much involved in making sure this person gets better. And that, by the way, the story about that, I made the introduction to the TED Med blogger, and the story on that was the most retweeted, Facebooked, et cetera, story that she'd ever done. Because
wow, that's really amazing.
So I'm with
and,
you.
And, you know, it strikes me as an emergency physician, you know, and I think this is one of the wonderful things about medicine is how patients from the past, you know, populate your memory and come back and you think about them. And as you told that story, I was thinking about a man who was brought in to the emergency department at Kaiser San Francisco where I was working. And he was, I don't know, like in his late 60s. And he had been paralyzed and required total care. You know, he was bedridden, total care for the preceding 10 years. And the whole family came in, and my first reaction to him was, oh, my God, why are they, you know, kind of, you know, maybe he just needs to go to a nursing home or, you know, the kind of thoughts that you have when you don't think about the person as a person. And it turned out that the family had provided all this care and that this man, although he was paralyzed, and to me, he was a paralyzed guy in bed too, right? It was a huge part of their family, and it was this big wake-up call to me. Whoa, you know? And I don't know exactly, particularly in a practice like emergency medicine where you don't even have your 15 minutes, right? You're running from patient to patient, how you could be able to get this humanness, you know, back into the interaction. And I guess it's a part of what this whole empowered patient-centered movement is that patients are saying, enough already, you guys. You know, you've gotten it down to treating me like a car in the assembly line, and that's not okay with me.
Right. I'll go back. The stories are important, and I'll go back to the coaching piece. In the coaching that I do, I think that over the course of the engagement with my clients is that it does bring them back to the reason they're in medicine. And they can understand that sometimes the way they show up, which might be obstructionist or might be short or might be blowing up or might be not listening to people, gets in the way of their own joy at caring for patients and working with other caregivers to care for patients.
So what happens to these students? They do the 8-week course with you in their first year. Do you stay in touch with them? Are you offering, I know it would be hard during the clinical years, but, you know, some way of continuing to encourage their writing as they go through the rest of their training?
I do. I have distribution lists for each year, and so whenever one of them gets published, I send it out to everybody, and I also copy the Dean of Education and the Executive Chancellor or what, and my chair and director, so I make sure that everybody knows that my students have been published. I really want my goal is to do a 4-year program, and there's one at UC San Francisco that I've mentioned to you. And I'm not – Georgetown, I think it's more difficult there. They don't really have the space, but I'm in discussions with another medical school to have a 4-year program so that at the end they come out and they're writing and being published in the New York Times, say, or in Health Affairs, to where they use medical narrative to make points about policy.
Yeah, well, that would be fantastic. But even if they weren't published and they continued to write as a part of maintaining their humanity and their relationship – to the people who are their patients, it would be a fantastic contribution.
Absolutely. Well, thanks, Pat, so much.
Well, it was a pleasure, Maggie. Just the beginning of, I hope, many conversations.
Right. I hope to bring some of these doctors on, some of these patients, some of these med students on to talk.
That would be really great.
That sounds like a plan. I want to thank you, Maggie, Dr. Maggie Carey. We've been speaking with, now this is for the live portion of the broadcast, we're going to draw it to a close. We've been speaking with Dr. Maggie Carey, physician, entrepreneur, consultant, and executive coach. And we've been hearing a bit about her history, draw it to medicine, what she's doing in a narrative medicine series, as well as a little bit about coaching. We do this weekly on This Week in Health Innovation. Join us next Wednesday for another broadcast. And for those of you in overtime, we'll be back. Now, I don't know why it does that. This is one of those peculiarities with Blog Talk Radio and, shall we say, SaaS, software as a service on the web. Sometimes the buttons don't work as they should. So this is a great chat. I'm just going to step back out, let you know that I've been selectively pulling the series from The Doctor Weighs In and retweeting those. So FYI, it'll be freshened up as far as content on the web based on this conversation. So with that, let me turn it back to you, Pat.
So Maggie, do you have time? Do you have an interest in continuing the chat?
Sure, we can continue the chat. What would you like to talk about?
I wanted to continue on this narrative medicine. Yes. And I like the tie-in to coaching. And I think that the overall theme is really, there's a number of things. One is, the impact of this writing on as kind of a stress relief for physicians or physicians in training. The other is, maintaining the human factor, the patient as a human being factor. And then there's the whole thing of, the doctor as a writer and what kinds of contributions they could make. And it seems like narrative medicine could play a role in all of those. The one thing we didn't talk about much was what was the whole stress? Is there anything that you've been hearing from the students in terms of this makes it easier for me to, make it through this, pretty hardcore, heavy duty process of becoming a doctor?
Absolutely, and the way they approach it is that what they say is, I didn't know other people were experiencing this also.
Oh, so it's the shared experience.
It's the shared experience. I should say that, in my coaching, I encourage journaling and also meditation. And what I talk about, I find that the journaling reduces stress. Excuse me for a minute. Sorry about that. So when my clients and I are going into something very stressful, a meeting with somebody where there's going to be conflict, I encourage them to journal their feelings just before they go in. And then just after they come out, and then 2 weeks or a month later, because that serves as a roadmap the next time they get in that situation, they can see that it's really not going to last forever. And with my students, I encourage them to write, because by putting it down and sharing it, it really does somehow make things not so horrible. And I'd like to go back a little ways. I'd like to go back to something you said about, is medical training changing? And I told you a couple of examples. There is a movement to get it to change, like to maybe do some flipped classroom work and some other things, which means they do all the reading at home and then they come in together only to discuss cases. But as you know, medical training is incredibly conservative. And how many times did you hear when you were in medical school, well, I had to do it, so they have to do it?
So all the time.
Yeah,
all the time. Oh, you're such mission. A wimp. You're only on every third. I was on every other.
And I had to walk a mile in the snow to get to the hospital.
Barefoot.
and no clothes. That was horrible.
Right.
So I think the writing helps. I mean, that's why I'd really like to continue this. And I have Georgetown has a student started a group called the William Carlos Williams Society. And I should tell you another story, which is that I have brunches for them or dinners sometimes, a few times during the year. Sort of I get called up by the person who's heading it for that year and saying, would you like to have us over? I say yes. And one of the students who was in this society but had never actually taken a class of mine called me up and said, I'd like you to write a letter of recommendation for me. I realize I never took your class, but I feel you know me better than any of my other professors.
Wow.
And that was very touching to me, and of course very flattering. But the bigger question is, how about those other professors? He's been there 4 years. He's been in my house a few times, and he feels I know him best.
Yeah, no, that's... yeah, and as I think back on my training, there were actually a number of people that we got to know well, including somebody we were talking about just the other day who was a radiology professor and used to have the students over to his house. So we could see him outside of just standing up in front of the classroom. We got to know him as a person, and he was enormously influential in my career as a result of that. So maybe you need to teach narrative medicine to the professors.
Well, funny you should say that, because I've been in touch with some folks at Hopkins, professors who have taught and have thought about bringing it back to, you know, back again with an evening group, and our first meeting is going to be in September.
Oh, fantastic. I wish I was back there. You'll have to figure out how to do this long distance. It's something I'd love to do.
Well, why don't you plan a trip during one of our meetings? Or we could take it to San Francisco.
The famous Casa Carey. Good. Well, great. Well, Maggie, are there any last thoughts? This has been wonderful hearing about all the interesting things that you're doing and this focus both on executive coaching and narrative medicine, the work of which I think does have very important links. Any last words for the audience?
No, I would just say that I'm happy to be of assistance or help. That if anybody out there would like to start a narrative medicine program, please shoot me an email or call or however you need to get in touch, and I would be happy to send you my syllabus, which is one page. It's very easy. It's, as I mentioned, you do these, you pass, and I'd like to spread the word.
Sounds great, Maggie. And how should they get in touch with you?
medleadership@gmail.com.
medleadership@gmail.com. Fantastic. Thanks a lot, Maggie.
You're welcome.
So that'll be the last word. I want to thank my colleague, Dr. Pat Zauber, and our wonderful guest today, Dr. Maggie Carey, MD, MBA, MPH, on her story in narrative medicine and insights into executive coaching and the role it plays in the healthcare transformational process, which we're all, to one degree or another, involved in. So we do this weekly on This Week in Health and Vision on Wednesdays at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. Please join us next week for another installment of this broadcast, and we'll see if we can sort of edge out of this without torturing your ears. Thanks, everyone, and see you next week.
that was when I ruled the world.